Well, we're back at it again. We're returning to this 6,000-word essay by Pope Benedict XVI. Y'all really enjoyed the first one. And now we've had over a week, to read it over, meditate on it, think about it, come to some newer conclusions. I know my own thinking on it has developed some since that first video we did on Pope Benedict Breaks His Silence. And so back here with Tim, we're going to look at some more parts of the 6,000 word essay that we didn't cover before, and also some of the responses that have come throughout the world, in particular the response of Cardinal Mueller. So Tim Gordon, how are you this morning?
I'm well, how are you?
Good. As we were saying, both of us have a little bit of allergies going. Spring allergies, things are in bloom. My eyes are kind of squinty and watery. So
please tell us how red our eyes are.
Tell us how bad we look. Yeah, write a comment.
We want to hear it.
You guys look horrible.
It's always reassuring to hear. Thank you all very much.
We love that. Before we get started, everybody, please like this video, subscribe, hit the bell, support on Patreon. If you're listening on iTunes, write us a review. Okay, so I've been, reading some of the responses. We recorded that video right after it came out, so we gave our initial responses. Since then, there's been responses from the right, from the left, people criticizing Pope Benedict XVI. And some people, when they watched our video, Tim, they said, well, you guys were kind of critical at the beginning, and then y'all, awarded a lot of points to him midway into the end. I think that's fair enough. I still see this letter, the 6,000-word essay, as having a lot of truth and honesty and transparency in it, but there's still things in it that deeply bother me.
Yeah, I stick by my characterization of it. It's definitely true to say, as you did, that one's analysis deepens as one proceeds through the week. Consider any current event, but yeah, I was rewatching it last night in preparation for this, and I feel my analysis, your analysis, is still basically what we'd say. There are some aspects we want to plug in, but I think it's important to start out saying, look, I don't want to go overboard in praising Benedict, because he's still the one that left us with this. And in that last paragraph, he's the one that seems to forget that he left us with Benedict, and that Francis, and that Francis himself is violating all the good stuff that Benedict is admonishing. Nevertheless, it's 5,700 words at least of decent insight. So that's why we said it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the highlights were he uses the H word, not the heresy word, but the other H word, homosexual, quite a bit in his analysis. And, we talked last time about Benedict XVI describing what he calls the homosexual cliques that were established in the seminaries. And he's talking back into the 70s and in the 60s. So he's saying things that we haven't heard the current Holy Father, Pope Francis, say at all.
Right.
Also, as I've read this, I think this document is quite a bit older than when we received it. I'm thinking it was 30 days old at least before it was published to the world. I'm thinking after the summit in Rome, which was a big flop, failed, Benedict heard about it from people. I'm guessing, since there are so many bishops in town for that Rome, that he probably met with some of his friends, right? People were in town. And he responded. And I think this is the response. I think he put this together, and then it went through the sausage factory of the Vatican, Curia. And this is what came out the other end 30 days later. And I think there was some massaging. I think there was some polishing. I think the ending was probably added. That's my take on it. I think Benedict, as an older man, said, I need to set the record straight. I need to speak out about the homosexuality. I also need to make a defense of myself in a subtle way. And I also need to kind of admit and confess some things that were going on in the church that I knew about 70s, 80s. I think that was the purpose of this document. And I think our friend Pope Francis, our Holy Father, he allowed this to go public with the ending because he knew it would be a form of acquisition of power. This document is confusing. This document is controversial. Anytime you have confusion, division, controversy, guess who wins? The Peronist. The guy who likes to gobble up power.
Sure, especially a statement that ends with a kind of laudatory passage on the same one and the same Peronist. I'm with you there. Remember, you're sounding. I mean, your analysis is not unlike Cardinal Muller's, who, if you read the LifeSite synopsis of it, it begins with this quote where he says, "Benedict has pierced the boil," and in this text, he's more intelligent. Referring back to the summit, then all the contributions at the Roman Abuse Summit and all the know-it-all moral experts at the German Bishops' Conference. So shots fired at his own bishops, national bishops'
Ooh.
Conference. Bam! Good for him. Like, and
dude,
again,
I'm more intellectual than you. That's how Germans throw down.
That's a German yo mama fight. Yeah. The funny thing is, a know-it-all is a funny American idiom, I'd like to hear, or at least Anglophone idiom, I'd like to hear what that's translated from in the German. You know it all, where we're building a word. I'd like to hear the built out German compound noun for that one.
I'd like to know that one too. Yeah. Yeah.
Luta.
Luta. The Mueller thing is kind of interesting because we've always known that Mueller is a big cheerleader for Benedict. I think, you know, I picture Mueller just kind of like outside St. Peter's Square, like kicking cans down the road. Man, why is Ratzinger gone?
Yeah.
I hate this. You know, he's kind of bummed out. Yeah, know it all. You know? Yeah. So,
I'm sorry. German just sounds funny to me. I'm gonna say the language.
What do you think about the term Lance the Boil? That's what Mueller says. He says, Lance the Boil. It's kind of like, man, we're talking about a big, nasty pus pocket. And in comes the needle. So he sees this. And, you know, lancing the boil is not a cure. It's the beginning of a cure. It's getting the infection out. So he's not necessarily saying Benedict is the reformer here. I mean, he's Pope Emeritus, whatever that means. But he is draining it. And what's the language he uses there? Is it he was more intelligent than everyone at the Rome summit combined?
More intelligent than all the contributions at the Rome Abuse Summit and all the know-it-all moral experts at the German bishops. I mean, that there's some bitterness behind that. It's an apt metaphor, the lancing of the boil. When I first read it, I was like, oh, is this a bad translation? Do you mean piercing the veil? But lancing the boil does it accomplishes probably all the same analogous metaphorical work that piercing the veil does. In addition to what you're offering here, it squints towards fetid moral decay and corruption. Yep. And what's, you know, the first necessary step in remediation here is a grody one, to borrow my little girl's term.
It's grody.
Right. It's gross. It's going to get ugly. And And
we need to
infected.
Lance that boil and get some alcohol swabs on there and get things cleaned up. One thing I didn't notice until you just read it again is he's more intelligent than the bishops and then all the smarty pants know-it-alls at Catholiche, right? Or I guess that's who's representing those people. Is he placing
the
bishops with the know-it-alls? I mean, is this a diss track also against all the bishops? And by the way, these just aren't all the bishops. These are all the primatial heads of all the conferences of bishops that came to Rome. Let's remember that. In February, all the presidents of the conference of bishops for all the different nations of the world came to Rome for this meeting with the Holy Father. So is he swiping at them too?
It would seem so.
Seems like it.
I just want to say one other thing. I mean, I think so. But think of how strange it is that there have only been, to date, a couple critical commentaries on what a kabuki theater, what tawdry, cheap chicanery happened at that Rome Abuse Summit. I mean, we had a few right in the week of critics harsh commenters.
I don't think we did. Did we? Besides our usual suspects like us, LifeSite,
Boris. Well, yeah, so I'm including Boris. But besides the usual suspects.
You take away our friends and people we know, who else was dropping bombs? I don't.
So let's call it the first hierarch to even including, you know, the usual suspect hierarchs. I mean, in a good way, not the actual criminal suspects under investigation for child molestation or whatever. But we're talking about people like Bishop Schneider, who is saying he was active during the time. So he's not guilty of it. But there is value. Everyone knows, I think, this in getting out your surgeon's scalpel and just piecing something apart. So I was really glad to have read this Mueller critique. I mean, and to revisit, go back 6 weeks in time and be like, this thing was a sham. It was a pathetic sham. Nothing happened here, and we shouldn't soon forget it.
Yeah. You know, going back to Bishop Athanasius Schneider, he's in 2019, he gets the gold star. He has been speaking out the most out of anyone in the global hierarchy. Wouldn't you agree? I'm talking about every single event, including the main one that he's still writing. And I think it's wonderful is that God wills the plurality and diversity of religions. I mean, he's had three. So as I can count, three public statements or interventions on that topic. So it's pretty cool. Again, a German speaking ethnic German. And here we got Mueller. So it's pretty interesting that we're starting to, you know, I guess it's not a new thing. It's been going on for a while. But now we see some Germans against some Germans.
Right.
Reminding ourselves that Ratzinger Benedict is German. All these guys knew each other. You know, this is not, they're not meeting for the first time. Their relationships go back decades.
You know? Yeah, think of that video that we've showed a couple different times of during the Benedict pontificate, him arriving, I believe, home to Germany and all of the hierarchs with the German wing of the church refusing to shake his hand or most of them refuse. Yeah, there's definitely a rivalry here. Mueller is
lose your point here, but I've gotten so much criticism on that video. I want to set the record straight. We put up the video of the Germans not shaking Benedict's hand. So many people, I'm going to say in the hundreds, maybe close to a thousands, have said that's not fair. They're not refusing to shake his hand. I've gone back and I've shown, there's a second video I've put up, when that same time period, Benedict goes to Spain, every single Spanish bishop shakes his hand and greets him. That same year, maybe it was the next year, he goes to America, every single bishop is lined up and shakes his hand. So don't tell me that that's not Vatican protocol, or they were confused, or they didn't know. All the other national bishops knew. It's the Germans that slighted him. And so I stand by that. I stand by that video. I stand by those conclusions.
I didn't, for the record, I didn't see those comments. People had a problem with us having a problem with the refusal to shake hands?
Yes, a lot of people. A lot of people. Hundreds.
On what basis?
People. They just said that there was confusion, or that's not Vatican protocol. Germans don't shake Pope's hands, et cetera. And, you know, basically they were just saying there's not a problem here. And now I think you can say I don't know when we cut that video, but now several months later, I just think it's untenable. It's very obvious that the German bishops have been running things. It's very obvious from the St. Gallen Mafia that the Germans did not want Ratzinger on the see of St. Peter, all of these things. Anyway, I know you have a point here. I hope you didn't lose it, but I just wanted to set the record straight on that.
Yeah.
Well, and if you haven't seen it, go back and watch our video. Just search it in YouTube and you'll find it. Pope Benedict not shaking hands, or bishops not shaking hands, something like that. It'll pop up.
I want to take time, since that comes as a surprise to me, especially among our viewership or whatever. I don't understand, and I don't think I ever will. It's probably, this actually is probably a brain science / temperament thing, but I will never comprehend at either an intellectual or an emotional level that those inclinations. And that's fine. We're all different temperamentally, but those inclinations to take something that, you know, your brain and your heart kind of react together in tandem, right? Your brain and your heart are both having the right kind of instinct. I'm not saying you can never have the wrong instinct to a phenomenon when you witness it, but that thing, you know, people, most of the comments that I saw, and I think I remember my wife saying, I teared up when I see that. I'm just, they're like, yeah, holy tears of justice. Just seeing the Holy Father being, you know, done Sided. Wrong. Yeah, remember when Scout says, you don't do the gem that way. It's like, you don't do PB16 that way. And so, yeah, it just, it never fails to amaze me now that we live through the looking glass. We live in this perverse world full of, look at this week's headlines, look at last week's headlines. All these amazing things are happening, and they're not, the veil is kind of off now. They're open about what the events mean, at least on the other side. You know, they're openly not shaking the Pope's hands. Now they're openly publishing against Benedict and his few German allies. So the veil is really off, and people are just, if there's any justice in the world, even for those commenters that didn't like that we'd said that, it would kind of be like, well, let's not do a redaction here. Let's just, yeah, let's acknowledge that yes, it wasn't our lying eyes. There's really value to this. I'll just never get that sort of constant balance mode where you're playing devil's advocate against your own, do I listen to you or my own lying eyes? Anyway, so yeah, that's interesting. I think people should go revisit that video and look at it and then think of the German Bishops' Conference playing bully against Benedict, that's right, and his lone German ally, Mueller, yes, or two. There's a couple others, right, but they're surrounded, man.
Yeah. The video is called on YouTube. This is an outtake video, so it's only 5 minutes. So, you know, if you're watching this, you can pause and go over there. You can watch it later. Did German bishops reject Pope Benedict XVI? Video of bishops not shaking the Pope's hand. That's all in there, right? So just, yeah, YouTube, put in maybe, you know, Marshall video bishops not shaking Pope's hand and watch that. And yeah, you can see almost all the commentary beneath that. Oh, this makes me cry. This is so sad. I can't believe they did this. Right. But then you will start seeing people say, well, this is just totally normal. Y'all are making a mountain out of a molehill. But it's not. You can go on YouTube and see the French and the American bishops, every single one of them, 100%, with a smile on their face, shaking his hand. And there's a lot of grimacing and pulling back the hand. Maybe that's where Francis learned to pull back the hand. You know, maybe that's like a German thing.
But it's also an American thing. Think about, remember in middle school when you're going and you're shaking people's hands after a game and you do this and you're like, psych, put your hand through your sight.
Yeah.
Got your hand out of their dog. Yeah, like that. Maybe that's, yeah, that. I mean, yeah, maybe. The German version, the Smarty Pants.
Yeah, the Smarty Pants. Exactly. So, all right, well, that's Mueller. I think, like I said, I just picture Mueller. He's got his cardinal robes on, and he's on some like really majestic loggia somewhere overlooking the city of Rome from his cardinalatial apartment. He's like smoking a fancy European cigarette. He just thinks about it. He just flicks the cigarette off, you know, like he's just mad. You know, here we are under Frank. He lost his job, you know, he's jobless now. You know, he was prefect of the Holy Office.
That's it. I've had it with this dump. We got no food. We got no jobs. Our pets' heads are falling off.
By the way, I think we should just, all Catholics should stop saying Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. It's wordy. It's too long. It's confusing. Let's just go back to Holy Office.
It's much better.
I think we here on TNT, we should just say Holy Office.
I always do, because I don't like ostentatious phrasings, because it's just something to trip on in an hour and a half of rolling tape. So you notice I always say Holy Office.
Yeah, it was just Holy Office.
I shorten where I can.
Yeah. So he was prefect of Holy Office. He lost that. His, you know, Benedict's gone. He's under this Argentinian. He's trying to say Mass, and the Pope is interrupting him while he's trying to say Mass to talk to him about scandals.
The Pope wants to talk to you. I get it. I'm doing the holy mass right now, the holy sacrifice.
The representation of the eternal sacrifice of the incarnate second person Trinity. Yeah, I know. He doesn't mind. He wants to talk to you right now.
The Pope doesn't mind. He's like, I don't mind either. Make him wait.
But he didn't. Apparently, he interrupted the mass. So his staff is getting fired. There are cocaine-fueled orgies going on in the building for the Holy Office. So he's just sitting there smoking. He throws the cigarette out. He's like, man, you know, I'm done.
Remember the last scene.
Lance the Boyle.
That's another shirt idea, by the way.
Lance the Boyle. It's got Mueller with a jousting rod.
Yeah, or just flicking a cig. remember the final scene of Point Break where Keanu Reeves is like, it was one of my
maybe
childhood
it'll come
faves.
Back. Describe it. Maybe it'll come back to me.
So Keanu Reeves, it's 6 months later.
It's getting deep.
He's disillusioned with the FBI, and he's going to go catch a big wave, and now, Bodhi is gone. He's been lost to the sea. And so he is riding the wave, and the last thing he does, he flicks his FBI badge into the ocean, you know, symbolically and probably functionally as well. We're assuming he's not going to be part of the FBI anymore.
Yeah.
Mueller's going to flick his cig off the balcony, and that means in Vatican language, because all these guys do smoke the cigs.
Yeah.
Surprised me when I was in Rome. That means I'm done with it, you know, and then he walks off and goes and catches a fat wave.
Yeah.
That's Mueller.
Yeah. Point Break. T-shirt idea. There it is. Getting deep.
Mueller has reached his own Point Break.
That's right.
With Point Break. Bishop's conference.
Yeah, well, it's at Point Break because you got the point Lance is the boil.
Right.
I mean, this is wrapped up here in meaning. Yeah, and it breaks.
Point pop.
Point pop. Lance the boil. All right. So some of these portions, I want to go back to a couple spots that we already touched on, Tim. And there are some things that we didn't mention, and those are worth touching as well. I think perhaps the most startling thing that we didn't discuss last time was Pope Benedict referring to a young woman and the nature of her abuse. Now, he begins saying that this is Benedict. Our handling of the Eucharist can only arouse concern. What predominates is not a reverence for the presence of Christ's death and resurrection, but a way of dealing with him that destroys the greatness of the mystery. I'm going to pause here. I wonder what he's talking about here. I mean, handling the Eucharist destroys the greatness of the mystery. Could it be that he's talking about communion in the hand? I think so.
Why not just say it?
I mean, we know that in the later years of Benedict XVI, he stipulated, I think in a subtle way, anyone who comes to him for communion is going to receive it on the tongue. You see in all the later pictures of Benedict, people kneeling, but also him placing it on the tongue. I don't think he ever decreed it, but I'm pretty sure the Vatican protocol was if you're going to receive from the Pope, you're going to receive it in the traditional way. I think he was trying to create like a papal custom, which got obliterated, obviously. But it seems to me that this passage is referring to disrespect for the Eucharist, obviously, but it has the word handling of the Eucharist. So it could be in the administration with extraordinary ministers of Holy Communion, lay EMs, with their Purell pumps.
Mm-hmm.
But
could
he talks
mean a lot.
Yeah, I mean
a lot in today's church.
I would just have said everything. I'm talking about EMs. I'm talking about lazy priests who have the EMs do it and go sit on their chair. You know,
gets me steamed. Yeah, I mean, he probably was talking about all that. One requires specificity in such moments. Why not be specific? I'm sure that's what he means.
Right.
But say it.
If he had said that, here's what's going to happen. All over the world, in the newspapers and in journals and amongst priests and rectories and all, they're all going to be saying, Benedict says no communion in the hand, Francis says communion in the hand. What are we going to do? Now, this already
still just
happened.
Said,
yeah,
I
know. I know. This
I'm
already
so
happened.
I'm sick of
people.
The kill switch. You know, yeah. I'm sick of the consequentialist kill switch. I mean, this is the game we're playing. It's going to happen eventually. Well, if you just speak truth directly, then, you know, then you're, aren't you causing the schism?
Yeah.
X, and it's like, no, X should always reply, no, if it's there, it's there, so be it. Just let your yes mean yes, and you know me, no. I'm sick of all this foreplay, right? Let's get around to the confrontation.
Yeah. One lady wrote me, and she said she watched our previous video on this, and she said, well, the reason he's not doing that is he's fearing for his life. And I just wrote her back. I said, when you wear the red shoes, it means you walk in the path of the martyrs. I don't want to hear this. Well, they're afraid for their lives.
Nope. Doesn't back me up.
This is why they don't have kids and wives, people. Celibacy is a call to martyrdom and to missionary activity. Like, Tim and I can't go to Thailand and evangelize people. We got kids at home, and it's kind of rough if we get martyred. I mean, I'm volunteering. I'll do it by God's grace. But at least my wife and my kids with no dad and no income, and that's a bad thing. But when you're celibate, you're set up for this. And when you're 90 years old and you're celibate, I mean, what's there to lose?
Yeah, you lose a couple of the worst years. You know, that I don't know if those are the golden years. The golden years might come in the penultimate phase of life. When you're in your 90s and you have the chance to be a beautiful martyr, witness for our Lord and for all of the church in this momentous hour, you know, 12th hour in the life of the church. What a beautiful thing. Who would want to just live out your days, you know, as an old man? But I want to go back to that for a second, because I've mentioned this before. The three M's of Christianity. This is my good friend Joseph's point. You know, mysticism and monasticism and martyrdom. And I'm designating martyrdom here. The three M's of Christianity are universal. Now, not every Christian is called to be a mystic. Not every Christian is called to be a monk or a martyr. But there should always be on the table, right? I mean, we should leave our spirituality, if we're lucky, open to being mystics, right? And not ride this off as, oh, this is a special function of these other people. Yeah, it's a special charism, but we should always be open to it. We should always be open to living the way of the monk. That's why guys like us and other young men out there do Exodus 90, to try to reclaim some of the monasticism.
Right. Well, even Lent is a mini monastic retreat. You get to live like a monk. You should be fasting, sleeping on the floor, you know, subjecting yourself to the cold. Yeah,
like and that also Lent calls to mind the fact that there's always a connection between monastic and mystic. But when it comes to martyrdom, now this is in the early church, this is the best exampled, the most often storied case that all Christians, even those of us in the vocation, the more common vocation, that of being a family man or family woman, where it's vastly less convenient for the family, it's vastly more ruinous to the family and disruptive to have a mother or father martyred, but it's also a prime example to the family. I mean, it's sure, you need to be around for your kids if you can, but think of all the children out there whose parents are alcoholics or deadbeats or high-functioning deadbeats. You capture a lot more. Think of how much better it would have been for that kid to have a deadbeat dad, for just his dad to have been gone altogether, martyred, and then he could always, you know, think, my dad's a saint in heaven, martyred for the faith.
You know who has this? Origen. You know Origen?
Really?
Yeah,
really?
So one of the coolest names is Leonidas. We all know him from, it's 300, right? Leonidas?
Yeah.
But there is a Saint Leonidas. Origen's dad was martyred when he was a kid. In his whole life, he talks about his inspiration for his theology, for his monasticism, everything is that his dad got killed by the Romans. So Origen's got some wacky stuff, some barnacles on his theology, but so he's not a saint. But his father is a saint, Saint Leonidas of Alexandria. I didn't name a kid Leonidas, but I wish I did. Anyone's like, hey, we're looking for a good Saint name. Like, name your boy Leonidas. And they're like, I don't know.
People think it's
like,
the 300.
They're like, isn't that 300? I'm like, no, he's a saint. He's a martyr. He's the father of Origen. Another cool thing about Saint Leonidas is during the persecution, they didn't have the Eucharist. They didn't have Mass. They didn't have Blessed Sacrament. So you know what they would do? They would take the baby Origen, who was baptized, and they would pray towards the baby, because having been baptized, he had the Trinity and no sin. It was the closest thing they had to the presence of God. That's wow. Cool.
That's cool.
And then the dad gets killed. So look him up, man. Saint Leonidas, name your baby. I hope after this TNT over the next year, is a dozen babies are named Leonidas, getting ready for the martyrdom battle.
I'm with you. It's a cool name anyway.
Wait, you got a baby on the way, Tim. Hold up. You got a baby on the way.
I'm averse
Leonidas
to,
Gordon. Leonidas Gordon.
I like the name. I'm averse to popular misconceptions, foreseeable popular misconceptions. I don't want everyone going, yeah, you should go Leonidas Maximus.
Magnus.
Gordon. It's Magnus. Like, not just the recent ancient warrior films. That's not right. Where this comes from. This is
Ben-Hur.
Yeah, Ben-Hur. Judah Ben-Hur. Gordon. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So yeah, I think this is interesting that communion on the hand seems to receive a criticism here. And he says that it is not a new reverence for the presence of Christ's death and resurrection, but a way of dealing with him that destroys the greatness of the mystery. So I'm guessing here that Benedict is saying, look, lay Eucharistic ministers who do not have consecrated hands and people receiving on the hands has destroyed the greatness of the mystery. What is worse? Everybody listening, what is worse? For Notre Dame to burn or to destroy the greatness of the mystery of the Eucharist? What's more tragic? That over 50 years, people handle our Lord with pedestrian, you know, just acknowledgement, you know, like, you know, that's horrible. That is the sacrilege. That's the burning in the church. That's the desolation.
Which is more... Assuming, which I don't actually assume in my heart of hearts, assuming that Notre Dame was accidentally burned, then you could ask the question and make your point, which is the more sacrilegious. Well, if it's an accident, it can't be sacrilege.
That's
so, because it's a mortal sin, communion in the hand takes the cake. Easy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's and so I like that he mentioned it. I wish he would have made more conclusions. And that's one of the, I think, the criticism that you and I had in the first one. He's making a lot of points. He's speaking truth. He's definitely pointing to all the problems, but he doesn't ever make a conclusion for it. He leaves that to us. And rhetorically, I guess that's somewhat powerful, but when you don't have much time and everybody's confused, you kind of need a guy to say, well, there's two. If you have two apples and you take another two apples and you put them together, how many apples do you have? Four apples. Oh, okay. You know, like, we need someone to actually take the two sets and bring it together and say, and this is the problem. It doesn't seem that he does that. And that's, I think, the chief criticism.
Yeah, the idiots on the left call this a dog whistle. That's the rhetorical, fancy rhetorical name for it. When you say something for an esoteric class of understanders, and in this case, it's not that small a class. It's sort of literate Catholics understand the connections that he's making here. But it isn't all Catholics. And the evidence for this is negative evidence. It's the fact that he won't spell it out a little bit better.
Right.
So it's what I keep talking about, what you keep talking about. It's frustrating because as Catholics that talk and speak, you know, speak publicly and write about this, we know what's going on and we know how we'll draw it out. But it's like, you should be doing this, you know, Pope Benedict. You should be the one making sure everyone, not just the most literate 30% of conservative Catholics understand this point. Everyone needs to understand it. Isn't it more important that you spell it out and articulate extra clearly for the lower 70% that aren't going to catch this? Most of the 30% that understand, you already apprehended this before you said it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Francis reads this and he in his mind says to his posse around him, hey, this is against communion in the hand. And they all go, yeah, but no one's going to get it. And they're like, yeah, you're right. No one's going to get this. And they leave it in. Right.
It's allowed.
Because yeah. Francis knows that washing the feet of Muslims hits everybody in the secular world, the whole world. Oh, how compassionate, how humble. He knows that wins him like a gazillion points in the public discourse. He also knows that these kind of like subtle, esoteric Pope Benedict XVI intellectual academic points only hit 0.0001% of people. And those are the people who watch TNT. Like it's a small, you know, a small percentage of people that are actually going to pick up on this.
The deplorables. Yeah, they're already lost to them. You're not laboring for their vote.
Yeah.
You know, they're incorrigible.
Right. Right. And you think, well, yeah, people who have a PhD from a German institution will pick up on this. Everyone else, they'll just keep on rolling. Doesn't bother him. Now, I want to focus on the most disturbing element in this. So right before this, he talks about this handling of the Eucharist. Then Benedict writes this. A young woman who was a former altar server told me that the chaplain, her superior as an altar server, always introduced the sexual abuse he was committing against her with the words, "This is my body, which will be given up for you." It is obvious that this woman can no longer hear the words of consecration without experiencing again all the horrific distress of her abuse. Yes, we must urgently implore the Lord for forgiveness, and first and foremost, we must swear by him and ask him to teach us all anew to understand the greatness of his suffering, his sacrifice. And we must do all we can to protect the gift of the Holy Eucharist from abuse, end quote. Now, this is absolutely heartbreaking. It is horrific. Here is a priest. I don't even want to call him a priest, but we have to because it's an ontological reality, saying, "This is my body, which will be given up for you," as he molests a young woman. This is disgusting. This is Satanism. This is Satanism. There is no other way to describe this. This is a man who worships Satan.
Yeah, to pose a parody between the holiest sacrifice ever imagined or committed on earth with sexual abuse.
An unspeakable act.
It's mockery. Yeah, and also I want to take a moment to point out there's always this connection, or there's maybe not in every instance, at least not actively, maybe every instance there's a passive connection, but there's an ideological connection between Satanism and child abuse, right? Even if you think about the concept of what is a witch, kind of even comes down through the children's lore and even in Halloween stories, witches don't like children.
They consume them
and often they sexually abuse them before they do so, which is captured by some of the Puritan lore in early American literature. Nathaniel Hawthorne had a fascination with this stuff, and so there's a ubiquitous trickle down. Anytime even a low man on the totem pole, a parish priest, molests a kid, he gets the memo. He understands, even if he's not some important, you know, St. Gallen hierarch who might actually be a Satanist, he understands through a kind of inverse natural law or just the proper natural law that there's this parity between child molestation and Satanism, that the ritual sacrifice of a kid, even if you don't end up eating the kid or killing the kid, it's a kind of a perverse ritual sacrifice. And it's memorialized here by him using the ultimate language of ritual sacrifice and mocking that language.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting that he's presenting himself as an alter Christus. This is my body, which will be given up for you, to this young lady. And it's disturbing too, in the Pennsylvania grand jury report came out, most people just had to put it down. You can't read it. It's just too hard to read. But there are also cases of marking the children with crosses and also incorporating holy water into the abuse. So again, this is not just abuse for the sake of abuse. They're making it sacramental, right? They're making it liturgical. It is and if you think about it, you know, Satanists, they don't have black Bible studies or black praise and worship. They have black mass. Mm-hmm. They are, you know, Aleister Crowley and all these guys, they are mocking the Catholic rites, the Catholic sacraments, the Catholic liturgy. And here we have inside the church, Catholic priests doing the exact same thing. They are mocking the mass and mixing it with mortal sin and child abuse. And it has to stop. I mean, when I read this, I'm just like, okay, if you're a priest and you abuse kids, especially you abuse kids and you use the language of the sacraments, maybe we just need to have the death penalty. I mean, Thomas Aquinas says we need the death penalty for heresiarchs because they destroy the soul. And also for those who murder with malice, they destroy the body. So St. Thomas Aquinas says both of those receive capital punishment. This is heretical. I mean, it's essentially, like you say, witchcraft.
Yeah.
I mean, these people need to be removed from the face of the earth.
Yeah.
Bring them to Texas.
I'm down. Say the word, Holy Father.
Yeah. I wonder if a priest did this and was tried in the 1200s, what would happen to that guy? Would he be killed? We need some canon lawyers, some canon lawyer historians out there. What would happen in the old days if a priest pulled this?
I mean, what would have happened in the early 1800s, the antebellum United States?
Oh, he'd be hung on a tree.
Yeah, no murder involved. Remember, the original definition, even in early America, of a felony was any capital offense you could be killed for. It's not just murder. People are so soft when it comes to death penalty now. It's not, which isn't to say, like, you know, your kid steals an apple from the store and they're putting her to death. There's still proportionality. There's still proportionalism. But the law for heinous, you know, satanic molesters, there is no proportionalism at law other than the death penalty, which approximates that. So, yeah, I mean, because it's not like we go in and, you know, there's a grand inquisitor molester that goes and counter molests them. That's not how it works.
No.
So even in America, even as recently as, you know, a century and a half ago, to just look at Google it. Don't take my word for it. Look at all the capital offenses. They are sundry.
Yes. And for people who are just now watching us and are like, wait, you guys are in favor of the death penalty. I thought Catholics were against that. Go watch our old videos. We talk a lot about death penalty and how it was upheld in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, and in Catholic history up until about 6 months ago.
We are not just pro. We are very pro. Mark Shea can think about that one for a while. Yeah, you're right, Mark Shea. I'm enthusiastically pro death penalty.
Yes. And anti-socialism.
Right.
All right. So, I mean, and I think it's interesting that Benedict includes this example, this anecdote, because I think he wants to pull back the veil and reveal how sinister and horrific and embarrassing this whole scandal is with priests who are using this language with these acts. It has to stop. It has to stop yesterday.
Yeah.
So, all right, I think we can move on there because I just don't want to think about it anymore. He also, we did touch on it last time where he talks about creating a new church. I'm going to reread that one. It says, what must be done? Perhaps we should create another church for things to work out. Well, that experiment has already been undertaken and has already failed. So what's he talking about here? I think he's talking about Vatican II. Hey, we tried to create a new church. Think about this, folks. After Vatican II, the church rewrote the liturgy for all seven sacraments. They were working great. The liturgy for baptism was great. In fact, it's way better than the new liturgy for baptism. That's why all these parents across the world are asking their parish priest, hey, I don't want that Novus Ordo liturgy. I know it gets the kid baptized, but I want the old extraordinary form of baptism because there's more exorcism, the blessed salt in the tongue, etc. Same thing with confirmation, same thing with the mass, same thing for extreme unction, same thing for the ordination. They rewrote all the ordination rites. Why did we have to write new everything? Aren't we receiving what our forebears did? I don't get it.
Do you ever get that question? This drives me nuts. Again, with the devil's advocate, Pete, dumb people think playing devil's advocate is a cheap, easy way to look smart. It doesn't. It's just annoying unless you say what you mean and you're raising a non-stock objection. They'll go, what do you mean better? How do you know better? It's like, well, my senses, my common sense, my prudence, my phronesis, everything that a human being is put together to do is to make snap moral judgments. This is book 6 of the Nicomachean Ethics. So it's not always easy to articulate first principles, like how I know Nazis were wrong. I can't enumerate all the many common sense ways that my prudence functions to tell me that the Nazi party was bad or the Communist party was bad. People will go, they're valid sacraments. So how do you know which is a better form of valid sacrament? It's like, it's quite easy. Yes, they're valid. They're just much, much, much better in their earlier iterations. How do you know? Because I'm not dumb.
I'd say there's two ways. First, Council of Trent says you can't despise the current rites of the sacrament, the liturgies and the rites and the ceremonies. So the stuff that was going down in the 1500s, it can't be disparaged. So why would you need to change it? And then the second thing is, we'll just open it up and look at it. There's more exorcisms of your baby in the old rite than there is in the new rite. Wouldn't prayers, and by exorcism, we're not talking like the film Mumbo Jumbo. You know, we're talking about the priest praying that the child would be removed from the realm of the devil and original sin and brought into the realm of Jesus Christ and sanctity. If he does that more in the old, wouldn't that be better for the kid? Like more prayer over your baby? That has to be better. If he places blessed salt on your baby's tongue to consecrate your baby's tongue in the old rite, but he doesn't do in the new rite, wouldn't you say that that was better? That extra thing, your baby received more? Like, just imagine if you had a baby shower. In baby shower A, your child receives all kind of like 18 awesome gifts. And then in baby shower B, your baby receives 9 gifts.
Right.
Wouldn't the other one where you received more things for your baby be better? Well, that's what it is in the sacrament for baptism. The old rite has more prayers, more ceremony, more sacramentals involved in it. It's better. Just like the mass. If you invoke a bunch of saints during the canon in one mass and you don't in the other, well, in the first mass, you have more saints praying for you.
Graces, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're both valid. We're not saying they're not valid. You baptize your baby as long as you... I mean, you could have a nurse in the hospital say the words and pour the water, baby's baptized. So it's valid. But we're talking about... It's kind of like a diamond ring. The diamond is what's worth a lot, but you can put a setting on it that enhances the diamond. The liturgy, the rites, the ceremonies are the setting. The sacrament is the diamond. You can take the diamond out, still the diamond. But you want to ornament it.
That's good. I like your 9 versus 18 numerical thing, because whether or not you articulate it every time, you're like, clearly this is better. It's like, okay, well, one of the ways that's the least arguable, the perfect science according to the ancient Greek philosophers is math, and it's just like, yeah, more graces is always better. That's useful.
Yeah. I mean, and the old rite just goes back to what they were using in the old days for the catechumens in the time of persecution. I mean, it's the old, old, old rite that every saint, you know, pre-1965 was baptized in.
It's not a genuine disputation, but there's a word of caution there, because as you're always pointing out, the Théologie Nouvelle, a lot of people, leftists, claim to be going back even earlier than the scholastic rite. I'm going back to the old rite. Mm-hmm. It's so old that it'll sound obscure. It'll sound new to you, which is right. Really, this is the Vatican II trick, right?
Exactly.
We're not just, you know, pushers and advocates of novelty. We're actually going back older, but it will sound new to you. It's like there's a danger in that.
Right. Well, it's just like they told us, hey, in the 50s, they said, hey, in the old church, I'm talking way back, the priest said the mass facing the people. And they're like, no, no, trust us. We found an old church and the altar was away from the wall, which means the priest was facing the people. And like, really? That's so cool. We should do that in our church. And like, you think so? Okay. Everybody starts saying mass. Ignore the high altar behind you. Push a Kia table out front and we'll have the priest facing people. Now we're discovering through archaeology and architecture that wasn't the case. They were always facing east or liturgical east. So,
by the way, quick other mention of Notre Dame, which at the time we're recording this is still a recent event, recent tragedy here. The Novus Ordo altar, not saying anything, but I did pray for a sign. And, you know, people know most Sundays I go to a Novus Ordo, but the Novus Ordo altar was destroyed. The original altar left.
The high altar
left standing, and I had prayed for a sign while I was driving. I was in transit while this thing happened. So I'm just saying, I don't know exactly what that means. What could that mean? Anyway,
I know what it means. We'll do the Ratzinger thing and we won't connect the dots. We'll just let it lie. Another thing that I want to mention in this Ratzinger letter is he drops a note to Hans Urs von Balthasar. He says, I will never forget the warning that the great theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar once wrote to me on one of his letter cards. Quote, do not presuppose the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but present them. What does this mean? I don't know. It's like, you know, maybe I'm just not that intelligent. I read Balthasar and I think, okay, 60% of the time when I read Balthasar, I'm like, this is pretty good. Okay, I follow it. And then the remaining 40%, 20% of it is, this sounds kind of heretical. I mean, the other 20% is like, this doesn't make any sense at all to me.
I don't know what this meant at all.
I'm just going to keep reading because I don't get this at all. And I think this one right here is straddling the 20% that I don't understand. And then the 60% that's like, I guess that's okay.
I think it's straddling the 20% and the 20% is borderline heretical. Because it's like there is a reason, and I say this as a Catholic philosopher, not a Catholic biblical theologian, as most people probably. That's my all my lacunae come from scriptural theology. You don't have those same lacunae because you're coming from a tradition where you know the scriptures, but very, very well. But you can presuppose the Trinity because of Scripture, right? It's higher than the natural law.
I mean,
and he's not saying that. That's what makes it in between them. But
right, I think what he's saying is, don't take the Trinity for granted. Like as we would say in English, but I don't know if that's what he means because he says, "Do not presuppose the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but present them." I don't know. It sounds like it's super deep, but it's not.
Yeah,
it's like, ooh, this sounds like a desert father. But then when you actually think about it, you're like, no, it's actually not.
He's insinuating that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, triune nature of God, is a natural law principle. And it's not, it's just not. You can't just reason to it. It's a supernatural law principle we get through divine revelation.
Yeah.
So I think it's either just wrong. Maybe it's not heretical. Maybe it's just wrong speculative theo. But You can't reason to the idea that
God but he says, do not presuppose the triune God. So is Balthasar saying, don't presuppose it on a natural law? I don't know. I guess we can't go look it up because this is not from a Balthasarian book. This is from a letter card, like a little thank you note.
Yeah.
You know, I guess when Ratzinger became Pope, no, he wasn't alive then. I don't know. It must have just been he wrote him a thank you note, like, thanks for having me over for dinner one day. By the way, do not presuppose the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, but present
them.
That's
heavy. Heavy for like a one-liner or like a cookie gram. Like,
yeah.
Hey, thanks for helping me move out of my apartment the other day. Here's a cookie gram. By the way, don't presuppose the Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Like,
but present
whoa.
Them.
Yeah, present them.
You know, I've been around at, you know, conferences and people who write in journals and faculties and all over the world. And every time there's a Balthazarian, I just get annoyed because they say stuff like this. And then they like kind of have this like look on their face like, I just dropped that. That was deep. And you're like, it wasn't that deep. Yeah. Not feeling you, bro. Not feeling it.
Well, people, something that many of our listeners might not know, when you present at a philosophy conference, that's very, to me, it's very peevish. Students of a given thinker often take on the charism of the thinker in a secular sense, right? And it's like willful copycat playing. And I always find it very irritating of anyone, less irritating when Thomas, try to lay out, objection, reply, all that, because that's actually very useful. But when you're dealing with an irritating thinker, then there's nothing more irritating than a sycophant anyway, because it's a cheap copy. It's like, yeah, Balthazarians, I agree with your analysis. They do tend to, they get that twinkle in their eye. They think they're going to say something just killer deep. And it's like, that was dumb, man. Wasn't that cool?
I like Aquinas because, you read it, it's very clear. 99% of the time, you know exactly what he's talking about.
No pseudo intellect.
You're just kind of like going through and you're just like, check, okay, check, check. Oh, wow. Yeah, I always wondered about that, but now I understand it. Check.
Exactly.
Check.
Exactly.
Okay, good. What's that? Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And occasionally it's like, let me go check the Latin on that. Okay, that makes sense. There's never really, maybe there is, but rarely is there a time where like, I need to find someone and understand what Thomas is trying to tell me here. I don't get it.
It's so clear. But on
Balthazar, it's just like 40% of their time, you're like, this is either heretical or nonsense.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you talk to Balthazar and they're like, well, I've had this happen to me before. I'll bring some of these things up. And they're like, well, the problem is you haven't read the entire corpus of Balthazar. If you read the entire corpus, which is this big.
Right.
So it's like, oh, I have to invest 10 years of my life to understand this statement? Forget it.
That's their favorite defense of all heretics. Yeah. That's more broadly than just heretics, that's the left's favorite defense of leftist theologians and leftist philosophers within the church, where they actually have to acknowledge some rules. Remember how they used to say that about Francis? Or like, have you read the entire encyclical? Right. Like Laudato Si? No, because I got time is money, baby. I mean, when it first came out, I pulled some quotes and I told you I tried to publish a critical review in like three places, never got picked up. And I eventually read most of it, but it's like, this is the longest encyclical in the history of encyclicals. I don't have time to read the whole thing. You should be able to pull a sentence. I'm not talking about proof texting or quote mining. I'm talking about a sentence within the context of that paragraph or two paragraphs, and it ought to make sense. If you're saying there are four persons in the Trinity, then there's a problem.
You're just wrong. You can't say, well, did you read all my books first? Right. I don't have to. Exactly. I don't have
to. That's cheap.
So in the Syllabus of Errors, people said, well, you just pulled those quotes. You have to read the whole context. And they're like, no, we don't. Those quotes are wrong. They're errors.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
We reject them.
Error has no rights. Yeah. So it doesn't have the right to a second look.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. Gone. Of first refusal means you'll look into it deeper later. Error doesn't have that right. You don't get to have. There are two persons in the Holy Trinity in your book and be like, well, just buy all my books, send me the money first, read it, then you'll see that I'm really saying there are three. Right. And this is what Balthazar and Balthazarians do all the time. I mean, how often does that happen through the ministry of Bishop Auxiliary Robert Barron?
Yeah. It's like, look at it in context. It's like, I agree, context is important. Right. You can't just like take half a sentence and then publish it and say Aquinas said. Right. But our statements stand. I mean, we put up hours a week every week. And do we make mistakes? Yes. Occasionally we do make mistakes. We apologize. We clarify them. I expect that from everybody. Make a mistake.
But they're details within details. We've never said there are two or four persons in the Holy Trinity. No. Right. That when you go to fundamental details, the way Balthazar
And Baldassare doesn't say two or four, but he does say things like,
no.
The son is eternally surprising the father, and the father is eternally surprising. It's like, I thought they were omniscient. Like, what kind of surprises are they bringing? Like a surprise?
That's straight wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that's the case, you know?
Yeah.
Christ was not in the hell of the damned, but it sure sounds like he is in Baldassare. So that's just wrong. You just cut it. Anyway, there's a lot of people out here going, Baldassare, who are you talking about? One of the wise men? Yeah. So yeah. We'll do a show on Nouvelle Théologie. I do a whole chapter in Infiltration on Nouvelle Théologie and highlight who these guys are. But we need to look at their theology and the philosophy behind it.
Probably one by one with the big ones. We should probably do a Baldassare show.
We should do a DeLubach show. A Rahner. Rahner would be the most important.
For the Germans, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so a couple more quotes here. Ratzinger says, indeed, the church today is widely regarded as just some kind of political apparatus. One speaks of it almost exclusively in political categories, and this applies even to bishops who formulate their conception of the church of tomorrow almost exclusively in political terms. Immigration.
Poverty.
Poverty, right?
Environment.
Yeah. That sounds like the UN, but it's the Catholic Church. How odd. Then he goes on to say, the crisis caused by many cases of clerical abuse urges us to regard the church as something almost unacceptable, which we must now take into our own hands and redesign. Here's the big quote. But a self-made church cannot constitute hope, end quote. So, yeah, you take this thing. It looks like a political apparatus. It's kerygma. Its message now is political. And then, by the way, it's full of these clerics who are molesting people and kids. Yeah, you're like, yeah, let's just dump this. This is stupid. You think of if you're a Protestant evangelical. I think of myself, you know, back 20 years ago, looking at the 2019 church, and you're like, what? Green theory? Environmentalism, migration, molesters. I want nothing to do with this.
And remember, I'm reminded of a point about Luther, since you're talking about
Luther,
evangelical Protestants. Luther. Humanism always has these two incommensurate moments. One moment is saying, human beings are broken. We can't live up to the standards of the Roman Catholic Church of chastity and sanctification. And I mean, early Enlightenment and early Protestant humanism. But the second moment is always this moment of, notwithstanding what you just said in moment one, that we're not as good human beings anthropologically as Catholicism has always held we are. Now it elevates us above where Catholicism put them, even though we're talking about our brokenness, it makes us godlike.
Yeah, everybody's human. Good.
Everybody's like a god is ultimately where Renaissance humanism went in with Luther, and this is really what he thought. So, yeah, like look, I'm what Luther ended up saying. People need to go watch this new Polish documentary on Luther. It is a red pill, even for someone like me that's always beating up on Luther. He says, ultimately, I can't live up to the sexual standards that he fathered bastard children with nuns. I didn't know that. I'd always just heard the half of the story that Luther was scrupulous. And I thought it was like, oh, because he's actually following his vows. He killed a guy in a duel. He fathered, he was always sexually sinning, sometimes with nuns. But shocker stuff that are just filtered out of the textbooks by the religious right and the secular left in a place like America. My point, though, is he's saying, I can't live up to this. Ultimately, it's God's fault. And he says this in some private correspondences produced by that film. It's a red pill. People need to go see it. Humanism is a weird mixture of we're not good enough, moment A, with moment B. We're even actually better than Catholicism said. We're not just...
Yeah.
We don't share in the divine life of God. We're gods ourselves, even after you just said right. We're incompetent and we're incapable of sanctity. So there's a very common thing
isn't
that
links
the
Lutheran,
up with what you're saying.
Isn't that the Lutheran light switch where, oh, we're so sinful, you know, total depravity, original sin to the max, you know, affecting the intellect and the will, basically just eradicating it. But Now we are just as righteous as Jesus Christ because God imputes the righteousness of Jesus Christ to us in a forensic way. He kind of like takes an envelope, puts Jesus's righteousness in it, seals it, hands it to Luther and say, this is now your righteousness, even though you're like a sinful pig and totally disgusted and not sanctified at all. You have the golden ticket and you're like, I'm just as righteous as Jesus. I'm bold before the throne because I've got my coupon. Yeah, I mean, that's really crummy theology, by the way.
Yeah.
but everybody loved it. Yeah, everybody loved it, you know? And then it eventually mutates into, you know, the American revivalist idea that once saved, always saved. Right? So you've got...
Easily.
You got that gold ticket in your back pocket, and you're like, you know, you die in a whorehouse, but you're like, I got this ticket. I got the righteousness of Jesus Christ. I accepted it.
And I'm going to be cocky about it as well.
Yeah. Not only, like Luther said, if you're going to sin, sin boldly.
It's called Luther and the Protestant Revolution.
That's Polish? The name. Is it in English or Polish?
It's amazing. It's a Polish documentary that's been translated into English. It's new. I think it's 2019.
I just love
and
Poland.
And this is where they keep calling them. Yeah, no, they do great documentaries. I don't know if it's the same group that did that Crisis in the Church, but it is really – I was learning stuff about Luther, right? Me and my wife watched it, and you know, she was like, oh, wow, you know, I forgot. Tim, hadn't you said that even Luther kind of believed in you know, and argued for the real presence of the Eucharist. Yeah. But it puts all that in context and it goes through chronologically. And he said tons of crazy stuff I didn't know.
Yeah. He was nuts.
It's worth a watch. I really want everyone out there, all the TNT viewers, to go watch it. It is fascinating.
Yeah. And wasn't it the last like several months of his life, he was just railing against the Jews in the synagogues. His last sermon was like just a terror.
Published widely. I'm forgetting what it's called offhand, but he was railing against the Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly, Cardinal Dolan came out in 2017 saying all these glowing things about Luther. Did you see that? Dolan of New York?
Yes.
I remember. Eye roll like, man, you are, give me a break. 500 years of Luther and you're praising him. Pope Francis put a statue. Well, he put him on the stamp, but he also had a statue, I want to say an idol, of Luther in the Vatican. A statue of Martin Luther.
I know.
Give me a break. As a former Protestant, I'm disgusted.
I understand. But this is one of those collusion areas. There aren't that many on which the religious right, as an American or maybe as, you know, in English, it might be the same, as a religious right, secular left, team up.
That's right.
Luther is absolute brainwashed. The secular left loves him. The religious right loves him. On the fifth centenary of Reformation Day, Halloween of 2017, Wall Street Journal published an op-ed that said that Luther's the greatest advocate of human freedom ever. He argued tooth and nail against Erasmus that humans don't have free will.
Yeah.
How can you be an advocate?
He wrote the book called Bondage of the Will.
On the bondage of the will. It's like, and that's the Wall Street Journal's op-ed page, which
They're
I usually enjoy as a conservative.
Yeah.
No, it is pure people. Please watch this documentary. I feel like I'm doing a service to you and to the filmmakers if – you know, half of or all of the TNT viewers out there, go watch it. It is phenomenal, and you will learn.
I'm going to watch it.
50 things. It's good. You love the Polish.
I love the Polish. As I've said, I'll say it again. After my kids graduate from college, I'm going to give them some money. I'm going to say, go to Poland for 6 months to a year and find a spouse, then come back or stay, and I'll come visit you. I love Poland. I just love the Polish people in general. In fact, a lot of Polish people are writing me now. They're like, come. Come to Poland. I'm like, I will come, and holding to my principles, I will assimilate into your culture. I will learn Polish. I will eat the Polish sausages, which I already love anyway. And I will wear Polish garb. I will assimilate into back home. I'll have my boots and my spurs that I'll look at, but I will assimilate. If I do immigrate to your nation, I will assimilate and become Polish. Speaking of the Luther thing, before we move on, I heard a sermon a while back at a Novus Ordo Mass. The priest said, as St. Augustine once said, if you're going to sin, sin boldly.
Wow.
I almost just like ripped my suit. You know, like in the Old Testament, when the people hear something, they just like rip their garments.
Yeah.
Like, that wasn't St. Augustine. What kind of... It was Martin Luther.
Martin Luther.
Who said, if you're going to sin, sin boldly. Here we are in a Catholic church. We have a Catholic priest citing the most blasphemous thing that Martin Luther ever said. And he's assigning it to St. Augustine. I'm like, man, I got it.
Well, first off, you have a Catholic priest quoting the heresiarch, Martin Luther. The Catholic name for Martin Luther is the heresiarch.
Yeah.
And saying the most heretical thing ever and attributing it to Augustine. Martin Luther did not like Augustine, by the way.
No, he loved Augustine.
Well, that's the red pill. No, I thought
he cites him all the time.
He does cite him all the time, but only toward that kind of stuff. The video recounts that this is what I said to my buddy who showed me the video. I was like, but he's an Augustinian. The story is, all right, the regular narrative is he was caught in this storm and he said, hey, if you get me out of this world, I'll go. Yeah. Total nonsense. So what he actually did, he fled because he'd killed a man in a duel, and he fled into the monastery, and from the beginning he always rejected Catholic theology, even when he was a priest. It totally contradicts, and this is cited chapter and verse from details of his life that no one knew. These filmmakers did a yeoman's labor of research. All right,
I
gotta watch it.
I thought I took the red pill on Luther. Yeah.
No, I know. I mean, guys like you and me don't typically need a red pill on Luther. We beat up him. How could that verb red pilling even have any,
right?
How could we be based in red pills on something that I've made fun of my whole life?
Yeah.
But no, I was deferring too much by, he came into the faith as a critic of it. It's an absolute lie. Probably more of the religious right than the secular left, that he came in, was a Catholic, saw the corruption, and because it never added up, by the way. This straightens things in my mind about Luther when I learned this. I just watched it four nights ago, Sunday night. Why would he change if he's originally just against churchmen in the church, kind of like we are, right? The corruption of churchmen in the church. Why, with between October of 1517 and like October of 1519, when he's at Wartburg Castle interpreting the New Testament into German, why would his theology undergo all these radical change? 2 years is fast. And also, if you're a son of the church, why not just be disrespectful and play fast and loose with rank and make fun of the hierarchs?
Yeah, like Erasmus did.
Yeah, like Erasmus did. But why start saying you don't believe in free will? Why start saying voluntarist things? Why start saying nominalist things? Why attack the ordained priesthood? Why start a revolution and set the world on fire if you're just angry that you think indulgences are being sold for much? This supplies the answer, because that is a brainwashed lie. He came into the faith as a kind of plant, much like the communist Belladonna, 1,100 or 1,200 men did. He came in as a critic, and he came in to do this. He never was a believing Catholic. He fled the charges of murder in a duel.
Yeah, I always heard at his first mass, he saw his father there and he cried and ran out after it was over. You ever heard that?
I've never heard that.
Is that that's not in the documentary? That's what I heard. That's kind of weird. It's like daddy issues, kind of a weird thing going on there.
Yeah, I forget. It covers some daddy issues, but yeah. That's interesting. Why? His dad would have been a Catholic.
His dad would have been a Catholic, yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
No one was.
All right, I'm going to go watch it. I'm going to go watch it.
Please, everyone do.
So, you know, as you're saying all that too, I was thinking, you know, the theology has changed and there's been so much heresy in the church, but the most symbolic things in my mind, you just want to look like sacrament. I don't want to use the word sacramental. Signs, significations are, in my mind, the 1986 Assisi meeting with the Pope standing there with the Dalai Lama and all those people. That is a flashpoint. I think it was in 91 when there's the picture of John Paul II kissing the Quran. That's one of them. the lightning strike of the Vatican when Benedict announced his resignation, right? And then the next one for me is Luther on the stamp, and then the picture of Francis next to the statue of Luther. Those are like these things burned in my mind. It's like, this is not right. My alarms are going off. Smoke alarm is screeching when I see this stuff.
Agreed. So
maybe there's more. Love to hear from y'all. But those things right there are just visual snapshots of a Catholic Church that's in deep crisis. And they're all from the 80s forward. All right, last quote. Today, the accusation, this is Ratzinger Benedict. Today, the accusation against God is, above all, about characterizing his church as entirely bad and thus dissuading us from it. The idea of a better church created by ourselves is, in fact, the proposal of the devil, with which he wants to lead us away from the living God through a deceitful logic by which we are too easily duped. Again, I think he's referring here to what we're living in post-Vatican II, and that is a church created by ourselves. Not the divinely appointed
that's
church.
Strong. That is strong. The strongest possible way you could phrase that critique to give it life.
That we could create a church. I mean, he already earlier mentioned at the beginning of section 3 that we tried to create a new church and it failed. And now he's returning to that theme again, saying, you know, the idea that we could create a better church is a proposal of the devil. Doesn't get any stronger than that. It's satanic.
Well, I'd missed that line for our last show on this. I don't know how you missed that one.
I would encourage people to get a copy of this. You can just go to LifeSite, copy and paste it in like a Word document. That's what I did. And read it through, but then go through and start highlighting it. So I like took the word church, search the word church. And then I just read every single line that he said about the church. And it's actually pretty well done. I mean, Benedict's woven this together. This wasn't just something that he wrote really quickly. It seemed that there is, like you said before, there's an intentionality. He doesn't connect the dots. It's esoteric in that way. And by the way, when we say esoteric, we mean hidden meanings. We don't mean occult. People always kind of, when we use the word esoteric, they think we're talking about, he's putting in like Freemason terms.
Aleister Crowley. No. Look the word up, people. Dictionary. Yeah. Dictionary definition one.
Yep. So, by the way, Tim, my new book, there's a lot of Aleister Crowley in it. You're going to be shocked.
Is there?
Because I can't wait to reveal it.
Really?
Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy.
How much?
A good bit. Yeah.
I'm interested. Yeah. I'm very interested.
It's all a part of the infiltration of the Catholic Church. Ultimately,
really?
Yeah. Ultimately a lead up to the Sankon Mafia, as you shall see. It's crazy.
Aleister Crowley. Wait, but
sex magic. Yes. Yep. You're going to see it all. So we should stop there. We're going, I guess we're okay. We got anything else you want to say, Tim?
Everyone, I said it three times. Everyone, go watch that Luther video.
Yeah,
it'll blow your mind. You should, Taylor. You should watch it with joy. Because I mean, both of you guys.
Yeah,
are
we should
converts.
Do a show on it.
Let's watch it.
Yeah, and we'll review it.
Oh, snap! I rented it for 3 days. These digital rentals.
I know,
I guess,
man.
It's the same with. I think I'm out of it. I'll rewatch it.
Is it a rental on like a Amazon Prime situation or?
We have Amazon Prime. We did it on Amazon. It was like $3.
Yeah,
I don't know if it was free on Prime, but yeah, we.
Right.
A friend came over and said, "Hey, watch this." He wanted to watch it with us, so we were like, "Oh, we can do it right now because I'm on Easter break." So yeah, we just put it on right then. It's about 90 minutes long for a documentary, but it goes by fast.
Solid.
It is.
Solid. Can like kids watch it? Teenagers?
Yeah, teenagers can watch it. There's some funny animations that the post, so you'll get a kick out of it. There's some like but it's high production quality.
Okay. And I'm sure if it's Polish, I'm gonna like it. If it's Polish,
you will.
It's gonna be solid through and through. So
maybe we could get those guys on a show or something. You'll like it. You're gonna be really into it. I meant to tell you about it on Sunday, but
I dig it. All right. So we are now in Easter. Rejoice. have some good food, get a good scotch, bottle of wine, whatever you like, celebrate. Christ is risen. Hallelujah. And again, thanks for everybody for the support. Please like this video, subscribe, write a review on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Taylor R. Marshall. There's a second R in there, Taylor R. Marshall. And Timothy is Tim O. Theology. Spell that for
me. T-I-M-O-T-H-E-E-O-L-O-G-Y. Yeah, not to be cutesy. We just couldn't get it with the Y.
Yep. And couldn't get the Tim Gordon. There is a Tim Gordon guy who gets kind of miffed every once in a while because people tag him.
The Protestant dude.
He's like, who is, why are you always tagging me?
I love Luther. Stop saying all these anti-Luther things. I'm Lutheran.
That's right.
Sorry, Timothy Gordon. That's weird to say.
Yeah, exactly. All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much. God bless. Christ is risen. Hallelujah. Out.